to the post game. Eric Beiler joins us. So you might have seen Eric in a number of clips, especially on Rebel headquarters. So he shoots a lot of those, especially the live streams. He takes questions for Ryan Grimm. Well, I'm stepping on asking you a question.
Sure.
But you might have seen him recently at the Trump rallies. So Eric, let me just start with that. What, for the folks who don't know, what do you do at TYT?
I kind of specialize in talking to people at rallies, and a lot of them are Trump rallies, and also the resistance. And I usually put a phone on top of my camera, and I live stream. I have two mics. One of them is when I can talk to the audience. I have another mic that allows me to talk to protesters and Trump supporters.
Yeah. So you've been covering race for a while.
Yeah.
Right. So we're going to get to your movie about the headless Klansmen, which is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because my favorite kind of Klansmen are the ones that are headless.
Okay.
But before we get to that, what got you interested on the issue of race in the first place?
I'm a biracial person, and so I was always navigating the space between being white in this country and not being white in this country, in terms of family, in terms of dating, everything. You know, there are connotations. I made a series of films that dealt with the Asian American experience as a narrative film director, and then I got interested in documentary filmmaking. And the first movie that I made was about a law that was passed in Prince William County, Virginia, that required the police to check immigration status based on the appearance of the person that they encounter.
That's really interesting. When was that law passed?
2007.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm often reminded, and I often quote her, of Naomi Klein's quote, that if we get rid of Trump, we go back to a situation that was so bad that it created Trump. So,
yeah,
it's not like Trump is the first one to come up with these things. I mean, that law is back in 2007.
Right. Well, the person who calls himself Trump before Trump, Corey Stewart, he was the chairman of the Board of Supervisors at that point, and he used the controversy about this law to sort of platform himself into statewide politics, and he's run a number of times, and now he succeeded in getting the nomination to run against Tim Kaine in a few weeks for Virginia Senator.
So unfortunately, and this is what Anna gets frustrated by all the time, I get frustrated by it too, but not quite as much as her. Anyway, is that the bad guys get rewarded, right? So
yeah.
And they get a lot of attention from the press, mm-hmm. and that actually alerts their side as to, hey, this guy is actually worse than the others. And their side thinks that's not the bug, that's the feature, right? And so it's hard not to get discouraged by Republican voters, because they see that about Corey Stewart, and that's what propels them.
Well, this is the thing. They would have preferred a more moderate candidate. And all the times that he lost, a more moderate, he ran against Ed Gillespie for governor. Republicans chose Ed Gillespie. But where it all comes down to, you know, the crux of it is, and this happened in 2016 with Trump, right? This was, since everybody knows the Trump thing more, Trump was the one birther, and then you had 16 non-birthers. Trump got the birther vote, which is about one third of the Republican electorate. The rest were split between the other 16, and Trump wins. Corey Stewart, similarly, he's the one person who's running this anti-immigrant platform that electrifies the base of the Republican Party. The average Republican is a little, you know, he went down to Charlottesville and he organized with all those alt-right Nazi people and stuff. Most Republicans, I think, are like, eh. But then they have to decide in the general election, am I more comfortable with that, eh? Which to us is absolutely unacceptable. But to them, they're like, well, maybe I'm more comfortable with that than what these Democrats are doing. And somehow we have to make a case to them that they have more in common with us than they do with the haters.
Yeah. You are definitely kinder to the Republicans than I am. Because, I mean, I agree with you and I about the 2016 primary, and I kept talking about, hey, knuckleheads, stop attacking each other. How about you attack the guy who's at number one?
Yeah.
Like, they just never got it through their thick heads that Trump was the actual front runner. And so Rubio would hit Bush, Bush would hit Rubio. So on that, we totally agree. But later on in the primary season, as you remember, Eric, a lot of those guys were eliminated. And he would still beat people one-on-one. You know, if it was him and versus Ted Cruz, him and versus Kasich, he'd still win.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, look, there are two mythologies that have really kind of, made it almost inevitable that we repeat this cycle of when there is progress for people of color in this country, there's always a backlash. And it's based on two mythologies. One of them is that people of color are inherently violent, and they're going to hurt white women, they're going to hurt children, unless we use government and all apparatus of law enforcement to oppress them. And you see, we just did the Wesley Bell interview, right? That he's fighting that in Ferguson, right? Mm-hmm. It's very convincing. And subconsciously, it affects so many otherwise good American people. But they've just been hit over and over again with this idea that people of color are a threat, so we must use law enforcement to oppress them. The other mythology is that any multiracial governance, any democracy that includes people of color, is ultimately going to tax too much, take too much away from those who have, give too much to those who have not, and be unfair to white people. And this runs, you know, you talked to me covering this for a long time. This runs directly from 2007 to Trump's election in 2016 and all the rallies that I've covered since then, you know, that Trump continues to do. It's this concern that if we actually do achieve multiracial self-governance, which Obama represented, then there could be violence, and that appeals to like the Dylann Roofs who killed those 9 people in Charleston. It appeals to those alt-right kids who are so obsessed about the idea of non-white men having sex with our white women. And it appeals to all the people who consume that immigration stuff that Trump always talks about. Oh, they're not white, they're coming to this country, they're Muslim or they're Latino, therefore they're more violent, we must use the government to limit their entry into this country. The other part about taxation, you know, that's the Tea Party. That's the average Republican, you know.
So Eric, that's a really interesting phenomenon because it is mythology, but I think it's mythology based on projection. And so if you break those two things down, what did white people in this country do to minorities? They brutalized them.
Right,
absolutely.
Right.
Over the top, unbelievable violence. The lynchings, the rapes, the enslavements, the massacres, etc.
They guarded the polling places to prevent African Americans and progressive whites from voting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as I explain every time, we're not knuckleheads here. Do I think all white people are like that? Of course not, right? That just happens to be the history of this country because of many different factors, including politics, socioeconomic conditions, geography, the Industrial Revolution, the cotton gin, et cetera, et cetera. So we take a sophisticated look at it, and it's not just saying, okay, white people bad, black people good. Of course not,
yeah.
Right? And so, but that is the history here. Of whites oppressing minorities, mm-hmm. And whites taking the money for themselves. For example, you work and you get nothing for it. I get all the fruits of your labor. That's called slavery, right? And we had that for hundreds of years in this country, where white people robbed black people of the fruits of their labor over mm-hmm. and over.
Yeah.
So it got ingrained in the culture that is what happens if you're in charge. So they then think, well, if they're in charge, obviously they're going to do the same thing to us. They're going to rob us like we robbed them.
Yeah.
They're going to commit violence upon us like we did to them.
Yeah.
Now, they don't consciously think any of that. It's just ingrained within the media, the culture, et cetera. So they have that gnawing sense without even knowing where it came from. But where did it come from? It came from things like Birth of a Nation.
Yes, absolutely. So you imagine, here's an analogy. Okay, imagine if ISIS were to succeed and take over Syria and parts of Iraq. Okay, they would erect all these monuments to ISIS. And then they would write a history of how necessary it was to behead those people, to burn them alive, to make examples of all those who opposed them. Because all those who opposed them were going to, I don't know, tax too much. Or maybe they were going to do the same thing to us. And so all the children who grow up 50 years from now, they would be imbibing this mythology that defends what ISIS did in order to create its caliphate. Well, in the United States of America, ISIS did win. They won Reconstruction by killing and killing and killing and killing until the Northern administration, Ulysses S. Grant, who had conquered much of that land as a general, as president, he finally threw up his hands and said, we're not going to send troops down there to stop the killing. Just do what you do. And so they installed the Jim Crow era for 100 years in the South. If you were a white person and you killed or raped a black person, you got away with it. No convictions for 100 years. And this is with thousands of lynchings, right? And who knows how many rapes. So they established that was the law of the land, and we all became just very comfortable with that. But because they controlled everything from politics to the elections to the academia and the histories that were written, Birth of a Nation, that's a movie based on a book. They used plays, they used everything they could to create this mythology that the reason why they had to do all of that killing was, A, if we didn't, they would have killed us, because we all know people of color are inherently violent, and B, the Reconstruction governments were taxing too much and giving too much to those who have not and taking too much from those, the former slaveholders, from those who have. And that was their justification. And
yeah. And if you haven't heard us talk about Birth of a Nation before, it's the first feature-length film in American history, and it has a character who's a white actor in blackface, and he goes around kidnapping white women and raping them. And then the Klan rides to be the heroes of the story.
Right.
Literally, I know it seems unbelievable today.
I know.
Right? Or now back to maybe believable these days. I don't know, right? In some circles, the Trump circles and the Corey Stewart circles, but the Klan rides to the rescue and takes out the savage who was kidnapping good white women.
Yeah.
Now,
and the black lawmakers who were in the legislature, because remember, in the Reconstruction South, the freed black men were voting. They were voting in coalition with the progressive whites, the Lincoln Republicans, and they were doing things like, you know, passing public school, you know, they were creating the public schools, they were passing progressive labor laws, environmental laws. That was what they did away with. That's what they overthrew through terror.
Yeah, I mean, look, again, I don't want people to misinterpret this, but what I'm trying to do is break down the mythology. Okay.
Right.
If you had to pick a race in the world that has been the most violent, it would be a no-brainer. The white race, both here in America, slavery, the genocide of the Native Americans, and then in Europe, endless wars, wars upon wars, 100-year wars, World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, the colonization of the Southern Hemisphere, the brutal treatment of people in the Southern Hemisphere, and it goes on and on. It's not close.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean it's because they're white. That would be a really simplistic, ridiculous way of thinking about it. Again, you'd be shocked at how much geography goes in, has to do with it, let alone all the other factors of politics and money and all the other issues that go into it. Mm-hmm. And if any race had lived in Europe, they would have developed in the same way. Very likely, et cetera, right? So, but the reason I tell you all that is because it really is amazing. If I said that same exact paragraph on CNN, the world would explode. And they'd be like, oh my God, this insane person thinks white people might be more violent than black people. That's crazy.
When the air we breathe is all based on the notion that non-white people are the ones who are inherently violent. And when narratives like that are constructed and consumed, we all go, yeah, that sounds about right. Or at least, yeah, that's what Donald Trump needs to win, so it's just politics. And we forget to ask, well, what is the impact on our culture, on the fabric of our society, that the president is going from town to town and saying, well, here's a case where a non-white person killed a white person. And you know that's exactly what they did.
Now the statistics show you that undocumented immigrants commit less crime. But when he goes around doing a new form of Birth of a Nation,
right,
where he says, "Here's a brown-skinned person killed a white person, brown-skinned person killed a white person," right? It's demagoguery. It's propaganda to get you to believe that the non-whites are dangerous.
And that the things that they want to do are justified. Because if it weren't for the Birth of the Nation mythology, right, that Reconstruction mythology that we all inherited and we're all taught, then they were just killers. And if it's not for this anti-immigrant mythology that Trump, you know, then he's caging children for no reason. So they need to believe that in part because they've already gone down the path on the policy. So it's a way of justifying things that would otherwise be morally reprehensible.
All right, so that brings us to your movie.
Sure.
Who's the Headless Klansman? What's the name of the movie, first of all?
The Headless Klansman of Selma.
Of Selma, okay. So who is that Headless Klansman?
Well, it's a statue to worship the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, actually the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Nathan Bedford Forrest. And it was erected in the year 2000, okay?
Where?
In Selma, Alabama.
Okay, so isn't that interesting, guys? You know, again, there's all these nonstop mythologies. Oh, the players always respected the national anthem in the NFL. No, the national anthem wasn't even played in the NFL until 2009. Hmm. Isn't that amazing? The players were not on the field when that happened. That got added to actually because they had a contract with the military to promote the military. And that's why they brought in the national anthem and the jets flying over, et cetera. Hey, it always said under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. No, it didn't. It was added in 1953 because they wanted to discriminate against people who weren't Christian, et cetera. So Nathan Bedford Forrest, I mean, come on, you're attacking our heritage and our history. It's been there since
2000. Yeah, and I've also covered monuments that were put up even more recently, 2011. But in this case, the first African American mayor is elected in the year 2000. So even though the Voting Rights Act has been passed, even though Selma is 60, 70, 80% black over the years, the guy who was mayor on Bloody Sunday in 1965, Joe Smitherman, survived until the year 2000 by renouncing segregation and reaching out to the African American community. But by the year 2000, a guy named James Perkins becomes mayor, and the statue worshiping the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, who was also a Confederate general and a skillful horseman.
He was the head of the Klan. Yes. But on the upside, he was a skillful horseman.
Yes. Well, he's worshipped for other reasons besides.
He's a complicated character. I talked about his history before.
So it goes up 5 days after James Perkins is inaugurated on public land. The controversy lasts for 15 years. I just covered the last 2-3 years of it. But basically in 2012, the head goes missing. The bust is removed. Of course, the Daughters of the Confederacy and all the local Friends of Forrest groups, the White Selma is very angry. By this time, of course, White Selma, this goes back to the mythologies I was talking about. When James Perkins was elected, White Selma said, oh my God, the monkeys, they actually said this, the monkeys are gonna take over and the economy of this town is gonna collapse, okay? They incorporated a new town about a year and a half later called Valley Grande, just to the north of Selma, and that's where a lot of the white money went. And they did, they made sure that Selma did not receive the same kind of investment that it had when Joe Smitherman, when the white former segregationist was mayor. But in addition, they had this symbolic fight over the statue. The head is removed, and then a very wealthy man who actually wasn't from Alabama, but was from Virginia, decides he's gonna fund a beautification of the whole area, and they're gonna build it taller with a fence and cameras, and they're gonna redo the bust and everything. Meanwhile, they wanna catch the person who stole it. Eventually, long story short, the Confederates win. The statue is declared to be on private land because 100 years ago, the land was given to the Daughters of the Confederacy. And on, I think it was May 10th or something like that, 2015, I filmed the Confederates of the area, just Confederate flags everywhere, gather for this rededication ceremony, and they unveil the bust going back atop the statue.
And it was Trump's face.
Well, okay, before the year was over, I was working for you covering Trump. That's 2015. Trump announced, I think it was, he announced the next month, somewhere in June, like the 16th or something, right? Like that Dylann Roof killed those people, I think the day before Trump announced or the day after. It was the day after Trump announced Dylann Roof massacre in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Oh, wow, I forgot that.
I didn't notice Trump because I was covering the flag coming down. And I learned a lot of things that are along these same lines. Why was the flag up? Do you know why they put the flag up in the first place in Charleston, in Columbia, South Carolina?
I think that was also, wasn't that in the 1960s in reaction to the civil rights movement?
Yeah, just like the statue in Selma, it was a reaction to progress for people of color. So they put the flag on top of the dome in, I think, 61, or maybe it was 64, in reaction to the civil rights movement. Then in 2000, they had a compromise. They moved it down still on state grounds. And it was because of Dylann Roof's massacre at the African-American church in Charleston, that they eventually removed the flag. So I covered all that. But here it's like, once again, so it's a pattern. Prince William County, Virginia. They find out that in a few years, Prince William County, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C., is going to be majority people of color. And then Kris Kobach and his anti-immigrant lobby comes to town and says, we got a great law for you. You create tremendous fear by having the police remove the populations that you don't want. The police will remove people who look like they're immigrants. And a lot of people did flee. The economy collapsed, and they repealed their own law within 8 weeks. But politically, very successful. Corey Stewart's now the candidate for senator. Okay, then you have the Selma story was also, it was a backlash against progress for African-Americans, first African-American mayor. The whole thing in Columbia, South Carolina, it was the flag goes up as basically saying we don't don't agree with this whole civil rights thing, the sit-ins and everything that was happening, bus boycotts. And then you've got me covering Trump. And I'm talking to Northerners with the same grievances as all the Southerners that I talked to down in Alabama, exactly the same. The guy who put up the statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, he's got a stump speech, basically. He's also a city councilman. And he goes, there's an unholy trilogy in America. It's multiculturalism, political correctness, and diversity. That's exactly what Trump supporters told me was the biggest problem facing America, political correctness, multiculturalism, and diversity. So somehow, and we could talk about how, the Southern grievances that fueled the backlash against emancipation, the backlash against civil rights, the backlash now against Obama, and now this sort of the birtherism Trump movement, it's all become one conversation.
Yeah, Eric, unfortunately, I'm starting to get a little depressed. and I'll tell you why. I grew up believing in the other mythology of America. I believed in the American dream, yeah, land of hope and opportunity and welcoming. And that is how my family was largely treated. Even though we were Muslim, half of us look brown, the other half look white.
But, really?
Yeah. And so I did not realize how deep the racist roots in this country ran. And to see people react that way, what does it mean that the unholy trinity is diversity? That just flat out means I don't like people who aren't white. I mean, yeah, that literally means nothing but that.
It's right? In the film Headless Klansman of Selma, so you can see it. It's on the festival circuit. We'll make it public, on the web soon. But yeah, he says that. Actually, he says it twice in the film because yeah, he says it every time he speaks.
Yeah. So if you're Eric and you're half Asian American, or you're me, you're Turkish American, you're Edwin, who's our stage manager, you're Latino. That guy said, I don't like your diversity. I don't know what I can do about that. I don't know what Eric can do about that. Like, he's just saying, I don't like you because you're not me. And so that's a hell of a thing, man. And if it was just one guy and it was a one-off, it's another thing. But it is unfortunately ingrained in some of the culture.
Yeah, no, it is our culture. And you and I used to be conservative, right?
I did
also.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised by a military officer. I was raised to be conservative. And we all grew up, and it's not like these things are blaring red. Maybe they are a little more now, because Obama, you know, right, and all that stuff, and birtherism. But it's just part of, I'm ashamed to admit this, but when I went to Wesleyan, one of the most liberal colleges, from Hawaii, where I had almost no interaction with African Americans, they had this sort of racial sensitivity class. And they asked you, be very honest here, raise your hand if you'd be more afraid if you encountered an African American man in a dark alley than if you encountered a white man in a dark alley. And I felt compelled as part of my own education and initiation into Wesleyan, I said, yeah, that's me. I would be more afraid. And where did I get that? You know, from Hawaii, where there are no black people pretty much. It was from television. You know, it was from movies.
Yeah.
It was from all the things that came from Birth of a Nation. It's just part of our culture. And, you know, this is the thing where, you know, some of our viewers, some of our colleagues will be so angry if someone's racist. But can you really blame them? I have so many relatives on my white side who support Trump, and they feel that Trump is the only one who can save our country, and they don't care what he's done, you know? And they're good people. I know, because they're my relatives. I grew up with them, you know? And so that's why I can go to all the Trump rallies and talk to people, because I like people. I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. And look, to some people, quite consciously, the alt-right, you know, some of the white supremacist groups, the White Citizens Council, who wrote the demagoguery that told Dylann Roof that black men were raping white women, so he must kill. Some of those people quite consciously know this, but the majority of people who support Trump unconsciously know this, and that is that Trump is a symbol. Just like those Confederate flags and those Confederate monuments were, and other times when there were progress for people of color in this country. And it always came not just with the symbology, but also with legislative and political backlashes as well. And Trump does all of those things. He's the symbol, but he also is a legislative and cultural, political backlash against what did Obama represent? He represented multiracial self-governance.
Yeah, I was naive. I was naive about Like, I didn't get that some people subconsciously, but most subconsciously thought, no, I just want to keep my stuff. And even if it's at the expense of other people, even if it means I'm oppressing other people, it's uncomfortable. I don't want to think about it. I just want it. And if you take away my ability to oppress other people, you're taking away my freedom. Mm-hmm. And that's how they were taught. They were taught to perceive it that way. They weren't born that way, right? And so that's the depressing part, that it's in the movies, it's in TV, it's in local news,
in history books.
And over again. Yeah. It's in the history books. Where do you think we got it from? Where do you think those ideas exist? Your point about Hawaii is a great one. Because why in the world would anybody growing up in Hawaii think that African Americans are more violent than white people when actually the history of this country shows the reverse? Because you got taught that. You got indoctrinated into that through the media and the culture, etc. Mm-hmm. And so, by the way, one of your next movies should be called On My White Side. Which you just said, which I thought was...
A lot of my career, even when I was doing narrative films, is trying to navigate this. And the last narrative film I did, a biracial woman is trying to cope with the fact that her white father has rejected the fiancé, who's African-American, of her sister. And in the end of the story, she basically has to accept that my father is a racist, and I love him. And in order to not tear my family apart, I will accept that my father and my sister are never going to be... truly family to each other again.
Yeah, it's sad, man. And what I hope we're trying to do here just a tiny bit is to heal the wounds and bring people together and expose what we've been, subjected to our whole lives here, a lot of times without even realizing it.
Yeah.
Both the people who have received that propaganda and the people oftentimes who did the propaganda. Some know, like that's what Roger Ailes did for a living.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought he was probably the most powerful and the most dangerous man and in America and had done the most harm in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But there were most of the local guys who were working on local news, they don't know, they don't realize when they keep showing black faces, brown faces, and wanted, they're like, hey, it gives me better ratings, right?
I don't know when you were talking about, because I've been watching you today for a long time, but you were saying that when you subject people to poverty, it was Jimmy.
Yeah.
When I first got here, but he was saying that people who live in poverty are more likely to be desperate enough to commit crimes.
Of course, obviously.
Yeah, so when they started killing African Americans in order to amass white power, when they started massacring people, when they started the Ku Klux Klan and all that stuff, then they were completely 100% lying. They would go, a man would run into town and said, I had a dream that the black people were gonna kill us, and they'd all take up arms and they'd go massacre a half dozen or several dozen innocent people, That they had another one where, like, I heard them singing, and I couldn't really quite understand, but it sounded like they were saying they're all going to kill us. And they all took up their arms, and they killed people. But with the power that they amassed through that killing, they created not only those mythologies, but institutionalized legislation that prevented African Americans from succeeding. And so by the time, we're born, and the news is like, oh, an African American male has committed this crime, that's all we see. And that's kind of the big fight that we're kind of having. A lot of white Americans, a lot of conservative white Americans want to say, African Americans are to blame for their contemporary choices, and that has nothing to do with me. And then people who know a little bit more about history are saying, well, hold on. Why do we have these ghettos that have been abandoned of all public investment? Why are there only certain places that people of color have been allowed to live? And why are our neighborhoods segregated? Why did they not sell nice houses to African Americans? Why were African Americans excluded from Social Security Administration? The professions that they did, being a domestic or being a field hand, were not allowed to pay into Social Security. Like, why did our laws all the way along the line try to cut them out of the American dream? And does that perhaps explain why? I mean, maybe they're on the news unfairly focusing more on black crime. That might be true. But there also are people who are black who are committing crimes. And to a lot of white conservatives, they see that and they say, yeah. So that I might not like racial profiling. I might not like turning away people seeking asylum at the border or coming from Syria. But since we all know people of color are more likely to commit crimes and be violent toward me and my people, so then I'll go along with, I'm more comfortable with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So last couple of things here. This is not just an American phenomenon. So when people ask me what am I most proud of in the different segments that I've done, I think probably the one that stands out most to me was when I traced how Islamic fundamentalism grew across the world. Because when I was growing up, the Muslim world was a lot more secular. And I read a lot. I read books. I read foreign policy journals. I read articles. And I pieced it together. And it was the media. So two parties did it. One was the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. They struck a deal with the Saudis, the royal ruling family. We will leave you alone as long as you fund our media operations all across the Muslim world. They bought radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and they spread the fundamentalist poison that did not exist before in Indonesia, in Turkey, and even in Iraq, Syria. It just, they were deeply secular countries that became fundamentalist through that that indoctrination that the Saudis paid for. The second party was America. We doubled down on that media across the Muslim world. Why? Especially in places like Afghanistan, because we wanted the Muslims to fight the godless communists. So we thought if we make them more fundamentalist and teach them violence is the answer against the atheists, they will attack communists throughout the world. So the media is the culture, and culture is everything. So look, again, if I'm proud of anything, it's that we fought back against that to the best of our abilities, and we chipped away at it a little bit. And not only just for everyone else, but for me too. This has also been an education for me these last 16 years. So that's the one I wanted to end on. When I was growing up, I thought the cops were here to protect us. Only recently, I would say even in just the last couple of years, I realized that that is not everybody's perception, and oftentimes not their point. The point is to protect the powerful. So when they say to protect and to serve, I was brought up in a naive way of thinking that that was to protect and serve the citizens. No, but a lot of the powerful view the cops as their private security force to retain that power. So that's why you'll get stop and frisk for tiny infractions, but they put the Wall Street guys stealing billions of dollars get no stop and frisk. They get no law enforcement, because law enforcement isn't the point. Protecting the power and privilege of the powerful is the point.
Well, it's law enforcement is part of government, and that mythology infects law enforcement more so than other parts of our culture, because there hasn't been any consequences until very recently. There hasn't been any consequences when law enforcement commits acts of violence against people of color. And you know, people have said this to me down south, that they like, I'm sorry this is so offensive, but they like it when the police brutalize or kill an African American man, because it keeps the other ones in line. And that was, in a lot of ways, that was the exact purpose of lynching. It wasn't just to kill this one person. It didn't matter if he'd actually done whatever they accused him of doing, but it was to string him up and to create, just like ISIS, to create this iconography that expresses power, that we are more powerful than any law enforcement in it. I'm sorry, I'm depressing you again.
No, not at all. And Eric, that actually connects, just like you were saying in your grand unifying theory, right? Connects all the way to here. And so how Trump, after Central Park Five, were declared innocent.
It all fits together.
Right. They didn't do it. We found the guy who actually did it. He confessed. His DNA matches to the brutal rape that happened in Central Park. And Trump said, I don't care that they didn't do it. They probably did something else. Why did they probably do something else? They were kids.
He said that. They probably did something
else. So it's because it doesn't matter that they're innocent. It's iconography. It's scary black and brown kids who are coming to hurt you, and don't worry, the cops are gonna stop them, okay? Whether they actually did it or not is irrelevant. What matters is scaring the bejesus out of you so you let them keep power.
Have you seen the Negro Rule cartoon from Wilmington? I think it was Wilmington, North Carolina. So as they were, the former slaveholders were dealing with the concept of multiracial self-governance, the same thing they're trying to deal with today, they're dealing with in the 1870s, this political cartoon, it's famous. It's a vampire bat with an African-American man's head, and he's got these talons on his feet and his hands, and his little feet actually his very big feet, are grabbing white women in their petticoats who are trying to run away. And then one wing says Negro, and the other wing says rule. So anyway, that's what they say to justify these kinds of abuses of power. But I want to say one thing that's hopeful, okay, that can kind of give us all something that we can do. Because I think too often when we identify something as racist, we say, that's the end of the conversation. I cannot talk to you because I hear racism in what you're saying and what you believe. I think that should be the beginning of the conversation. And I think we should accept that racism is part of the fabric of our society and not reject it so much that we walk away from members of our own family, in my case, or members of your community, or people with whom we need to collaborate in order to make our country a better place. So accept that we all, I just said a few minutes ago, I had that belief until I reached college. We all are breathing the same air, which is what we inherited from America's successful white supremacist revolution, right?
And look, Eric, I think this was a really great discussion and a lot to take away from it. But the one I think that might stick with me the most is it wasn't their fault. They got brainwashed into this mythology. So through the media, you got brainwashed into it. We all got brainwashed into it.
I think most people, they did that study with the African-American kids and the dolls. Even African-American kids would choose the white doll and feel more comfortable with the white doll because of the ethos.
Right. And don't get us wrong, guys. We're not Pollyannish about it. Guys like Roger Ailes, no, right? And guys celebrating Nathan Bedford Forrest. I mean, not only did he create the Ku Klux Klan, he had captured African-American soldiers in the midst of the Civil War that were fighting for the North. And the rules were that you were obviously not supposed to kill the people that you've captured, but he wanted to send a message, so he made sure to murder all the African-American soldiers. Okay, he's a terrible, terrible guy, one of the worst guys in American history. And in the year 2000, all the way to today, they have chosen to celebrate him.
Yeah.
But for most of the people, some of the leaders, they're all perfectly aware of that. They did that not despite that, but because of that. But for most of the followers, they got told a story about heritage, and pride, and culture, and history, and all these things. And they're like, well, how could my heritage be bad? Mm-hmm. My heritage, by definition, is good, right? So let's, and if we do anything on the Eric Turks, it's to talk things out.
Yeah.
And so, and I said all the way back to Don Imus, Rush Limbaugh in a lot of instances, remember the nappy-headed host comment that got Imus banned?
Right.
And I was like, no, that's a moment to start a conversation, not to end a conversation, just like you just said, Eric. So that what would have been more fruitful is to bring Don Imus in with black leaders on that same program and have a conversation about why that was wrong, what people get out of it, the history, the conversation we just had.
Yeah.
If they had had that with Imus on the air when he said that instead of just firing him, I think it would have been far more productive. Okay, so last thing is, where can people get your movies?
Well, a lot of that work was done for a project called Story of America. The website is storyofamerica.org. Go to Rebel HQ and the Young Turks channel. Just look me up, Eric Beiler, Young Turks, to see all the stuff I do for you guys, because I do think it is part of one story, especially when I talk to the alt-right or I talk to Trump supporters. And The Headless Clans of Selma, it's not out yet. It's still on the festival circuit. But if you live in Kansas City, you can see it at the Kansas International Film Festival next month.
Well, as we know, for all the volunteers in Brent Welder and James Thompson races, there are a lot of you who live in Kansas.
Yeah.
So go check that out.
Yeah.
You'll be among the first to see the movie.
Yep.
And look, let me leave you on a positive note. So they poison the world, but we can unpoison the world. And we can use some of that same American mythology to our benefit, because part of the marketing campaign was freedom, liberty, equality of opportunity, right? To protect and to serve. Well, rule of law. Mm-hmm. Well, we can actually use those things for real instead of as a gimmick. And we can say, hey, look, what were we all taught? Land of hope and opportunity, equality of opportunity, rule of law. We can look at what Wesley Bell's doing now. Now he's saying rule of law for everyone.
Yep.
If we have a progressive president, we can say, hey, don't you guys believe in rule of law? Conservatives are gonna say, yeah, great. Well, rule of law for Wall Street too. And by the way, that will be an enormously popular thing to do. So that's why I say don't run away from the flag, run towards the flag. Because even if they were marketing gimmicks, those are things that at least spread a positive message in the world and that we could use to actually deliver on that promise. And so I think that's what we got coming up. And over the next several years, and I truly, truly believe that. And I'm not just optimistic. In 2016, I was not remotely optimistic.
Yeah.
Right? And but I think it's factual. I think it's realistic. I think we're going to win. And when we do, we have a chance to do some of those positive things to straighten out what was wrong. All right, Eric Beiler, thank you, brother. Thanks for joining us. All right, thank you for working at TYT. All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow.